So the title of the first chapter is Freedom and License. What is freedom? Ability to do what we want. That's our general understanding of what freedom is. Why does a human being seek freedom? We need to know that. Because that's our nature. We may think that we're bound in this little body and these interactions with relatives and friends and the world of things and beings. But we are not. We never were. The idea of being bound is like what Gurudev used to tell us. He said that is like someone embracing a tree trunk, then shouting, "Please free me, free me, the tree is holding me." You see, that's not the case. That never was. It's not the tree that's holding on to you. It's us holding on to that tree of samsara. Samsara means this universe of things and beings. Samsara, the word in Sanskrit. Sarati, samsarati iti samsara means that which constantly changes. That which constantly changes is this world. It makes sense. Make very much sense. And so we get wound up in this ever-changing world looking for that freedom because we think we are bound. And as I said, the reason we look for freedom at all times, to be free, because that's our nature. Our fundamental nature is free. I am free. I was never bound by anything, anybody, anytime, any place, any circumstance. So it is like a rope lying in the midst of the road and at the in the evening time when the sun is set but the darkness has fully not taken over. Somebody is walking along this rural road and sees something lying in the road, some curly thing lying. And the first thing that hits that person is, oh God, it's a snake. The dull evening, the light of the sun has gone down. You can't see very clearly. And so something that is sitting in the middle of the road, a little curly thing, appears to be a snake. And as soon as we understand that there is a snake, all the apprehensions connected with that snake come to us. What will happen? If the snake bites me, where will I go? This is a rural area. There is no hospital. There is no doctor here. There is no person here. Who will take me to some place where I can be cured or I can be treated? All these funny ideas come and one gets so excited and so concerned and so worried and starts shaking, looking at that wiggly thing sitting in the road. And lo and behold, some other guy comes from the back. He's also walking, but he happens to have a flashlight. So he says, "Why are you shivering so much?" And I say, "Oh, well, that is a big snake." So yeah, he puts the flashlight, and lo and behold, it's only a rope. It's only a rope. As soon as we understand, realize that it's rope and not snake, all the apprehensions, all the worries, all the concerns immediately drop. We become happy. So now this is what the word is. If you see the snake, it is there. If you only see the rope, the snake is not there. But the reason you even see the snake or the snake appears to be there and the cause of that is that rope. Without that rope, you could never see the snake. So then the Shastras, the scriptures say that the divine that is into everything and being of this universe, that enlivening spirit that is common to all things and beings, because it is there, together it appears to be the world. But the world is really not there. Now, that's kind of hard because on day-to-day basis we deal with it. We do things, we interact, our lives go on because of that. So the idea is that while interacting in this relative reality called the world, if we have firm understanding and conviction based on that understanding, that the world is not there. Only Brahman is there, only the divine is there. Whatever name you call it by, it's immaterial. Once that conviction comes, where is the fear? Because the snake has disappeared for good. So that is the freedom that we are talking about. When Swamiji says freedom and license, that freedom that we would eventually attain is attainable through a process. And that process is what you can sum up as meditation. Various ways to explain that. Once your mind is purified, because now you see the Lord everywhere in everyone, there is no fear of interacting with anybody. You interact with pleasure, with joy, because you are essentially interacting with your own self. And when that clarity of thought comes, the mind becomes absolutely, totally, completely quiet. And in that mind, when you are in the seat of meditation, the divine begins to shine. So that's where we have to go, ultimately. This book, the tail end of it, that's where it will take us. So in the chapter number 1, that says freedom and license. So Anil, you must have discussed, I'm sure, that the problems that we are having, and we have only two problems. One is me and mine, the other is you and yours. I want to keep what is me and mine. I want to acquire what's you and yours. That is the fundamental activity in this whole world. Everybody is busy doing that. So that means likes and dislikes. I want to keep what I like. I want to stay away as much as I could from what I don't like. This process, we spent our entire life. And what it gives us eventually is immense sorrow, immense unhappiness. It leads to misery. Because we are looking for that freedom, that joy, that happiness outside in the world. And it's not there. Because we want permanent happiness. In all places, at all times, in all circumstances, we want to be very happy. But this likes and dislikes business doesn't allow us to do that. Because likes and dislikes are created because of that misunderstanding. Me and mine, you and yours. So once we develop the discipline through studies with proper teachers who are well versed, these studies can lead us to the purity of mind that we need. Even in the relative life, with the relative purity of mind, we do create a focus. Look into your lives, each one of us. When you're sitting in an exam, what do? We force ourselves to get rid of the extraneous thoughts so that we can stay focused on a particular subject matter for a certain length of time at least. So we know how to do it. It's not that we don't know. It's not that it's something totally unknown. We know it, we do it. And yet, that's only the interaction with the relative world. What we need to do is interact with ourselves. So when computers have their own fun, they turn off without notice. So as first chapter says, in spite of this amazing, wonderful discoveries based on the most modern advanced technology and science, where man has conquered, so to say, so many avenues that he thought were in the way of his happiness and freedom. And yet, more than ever today, the man is miserable. Because we dissipate our energy running after the things and beings indiscriminately. All the energy is dissipated there. Then at the end of the day, you come home after 9 hours of work. You want to quit the job, but you can't do that because you have family. Family to feed, right? To bring the food on the table. So as miserable as we are, we keep doing the same thing again and again without thinking, is there a way out of it? Because there is. The fact that we are all sitting here and have been coming to this group discussion is very indicative of our desire to get out of this rat race. One of the acharyas used to say that when this, we are all in this rat race, and when the race is over, the rat will still remain. And so we don't want to be that rat. Okay? We are not rat. We are lion. We are not rat. We are lion. We're the best of them. That mindset has to be developed. The mindset comes from disciplining your activities, interactions with this world of things and beings by coordinated response to every call for interaction. What is that coordinated response? The coordinated response of mind, intellect, memory, and ego. These are the four aspects of what we generally call mind. Mind is known as antahkarana, the inner equipment. Antah means inner. Karana means equipment. Antahkarana. It is fourfold. It has four aspects. The emotional aspect is handled by mind, as we call it. The intellectual, the discriminatory aspect of what should I do, what is the right thing to do, not what is pleasant thing to do, but what is the right thing to do. That kind of decision-making power rests with the intellect. But that intellect that makes this decision has to depend on something, and therefore the intellect takes support from memory. Years and years and years and years and births and births and births and births, we have collected this memory, this cumulative memory that we have. That indicates to the intellect, every time there's an interaction waiting to be done, the intellect falls on memory and says, what should I do? So intellect pulls out past experiences. I mean, memory pulls out past experiences. Okay, this is what we should do. In this circumstance, at this place and at this time, this is the right thing to do. And then the ego says, okay, I'll do it. That ego, I, is the one that makes us do everything. So this is the coordination that is required. When the sense objects create stimuli that's brought in by our sense organs, organs of perception, every interaction in this world can be classified as one of the five. Experiment. Nose, eyes, ears, touch, and smell, and taste. Every experience we have is based on one or more of these five organs of perception. But once the entire stimuli comes in, it becomes one, and it goes to the mind. I'm trying to share how the process works. We have known this, I'm sure, but nonetheless, it's fun. So now the mind only has one status originally. That status is, mind is receiving and shipping Clark. It receives, it ships. It receives, ships. It has no decision-making power. That power is supposed to rest with the discriminatory intellect. But look what we have done. In the vast majority of our interactions, if not all of them, we have sidelined the intellect. The mind says, I don't need it. How often do I use it? Mind has this tendency to take over. You have to realize that and say, no, no, no. You're only number two in the hierarchy from the bottom. Number one, actually, because sense organs are a different set of equipment. You are only number one in the hierarchy at the bottom. There are three bosses you have. So that mind is supposed to take that stimuli and take it to intellect, says, sir, what should I do? Then intellect falls back on the memory and says, what shall we do? What's the right thing? So it comes up with the answer and the ego says, okay, let's do it. So that order then comes back through intellect to the mind, and mind is not supposed to mess with it. it is supposed to pass that order onto the organs of action so that we can interact with the world of objects. That is the coordinated response. Once we develop this habit of coordinated response, not shooting from the hips like the cowboys, once that process is developed, once we practice this in our interactions day to day for a long time to come, it becomes a second habit not to quickly shoot from the hips. Think about it, guys, think about it. Now this process that we described, it took us a long time to even describe it in a summary fashion. But when it happens, it almost happens instantaneously. So this kind of time is not there. And that's why we need to practice. All this give and take between the four aspects of what we generally know as mind happens so quickly. Fraction of the fraction of a second it happens. That's why we need to practice. Once we start practicing, that freedom comes. Freedom from what? Freedom from being affected by all these sorrows of life. Because they are not real. We have nothing to do. The world, you learn, you all have actually gone through from the back door and you have learned Bhagavad Gita first. So this teaching should come back to you. That once we develop this habit of maintaining equipoise in all the circumstances, freedom is attained. So that's the freedom that Anilji was talking about in the chapter number first. And because, as I said before, because our nature, essentially our nature is being free, freedom is our essential nature, and therefore we don't like any kind of shackles, restrictions, limitations. We fight tooth and nail every time. Think about it. Because we know we are free. We are just temporarily misguided to fall into this wrong thought that we are bound and we are restrained and we are limited and we are... No, we're not. We never were. I want to be free, people say. My God, you are never bound. Free from what? One who is never bound, where is the question of freedom? You see, that is the idea. So that, when that understanding and conviction comes, then you come, sit here, or you go in the middle of the market on a Sunday morning, where there's so much noise, and you can do your meditation anywhere. Because meditation is not an activity. Cannot do it. Meditation you cannot do. Meditation is state of mind. This understanding that I am free. That is meditation. So once you study the text, which you have really, you are all extremely fortunate because you have gone through so many of this scriptural entire Bhagavad Gita. That is the essence of everything that a man, a a human being has to know. So this insight, this subjective scientific analysis would make us understand that in our interactions with this world of things and beings, we must restrain ourselves. Not at the slightest sign of provocation, or run into it with two hands and less of what? No. Hold on, no. I'm the worst in that regard, particularly when I'm driving. I get upset. My driver's getting in front of me and all kinds. I've conscientiously tried very, very, very hard over the years to control that. I'm telling you, that thing pops up when you least expect it. Before you know, you have committed that. That's not good. That's why the practice. In Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavan says the same thing. Abhyasena tu kaunteya. With proper study and practice, only this will come. Because it's so simple sounding that we think, oh yeah, there's not much to it. Let me finish this thing, let me have my family, let the children go to the college, and then we will enjoy the grandchildren. And then when they're big and they're old, and then there's not a huge amount of work to do, then we'll think about it. That mindset can never be developed. Because it never was there. It has to come from the beginning. And what is the beginning? Whenever we decide is our beginning. Shankaracharya began at the age of 6. He was taking a bath in the river. This is just a story, but behind that there's a profound thought. He was taking a bath in the river and his mom was next, right there. And then all of a sudden a crocodile came and grabbed his leg. The 6-year-old boy said, I'm just going to be devoured by this menacing animal. So he looks at his mom, says, I only had one desire, mom. I want to be a sannyasi. I want to be a mendicant. And mom looked at him and looked at the alligator or crocodile that was dragging this kid into deeper water every second. She thought, well, let him have his wish while he's still around. Who knows how many more minutes he's going to be around. So, because in our system of thought, if somebody wants to take sannyas, become Swami, they have to, if they are young enough and not married, then they have to go to their parents, ask for permission. If they are married, the spouse has to go to the counterpart, ask for permission. Unless that permission is received, you cannot become one. So mother says yes. And while the crocodile still had his leg in the mouth, this little young man, young boy actually, 6, took water in his right hand, made an oblation into water 3 times. Sanyastamaya, sanyastamaya, sanyastamaya. Now I have become sannyasi. And that crocodile must have thought, now this mendicant, what fun is it to eat him? So it's, the story goes to say that the alligator left him and disappeared the cock. And so this little 6-year-old boy took off on foot, traveling across the length and breadth of India, search of education and a good teacher. That's the story. And most of the books that we have studied and we are studying are his commentaries. Even the English commentary that Pooja Gurudev has written in Bhagavad Gita, all based on his Sanskrit commentary. So the idea is, if you resolve, you can do it. You have no real excuse to blame it on anybody else, okay? That never works. You may get away with it for a while here and there. You made it happen. You clean it up. Simple life. Nobody else can ever do it for you. So that is good. There's no dependency on anybody. I can do it. Yes, so do it. So when that kind of discipline is established at highest intellectual level, that results into what we call freedom. And that then leads into the second chapter. The second chapter is called Art of Right Contact. Contact we must. There is no choice. Think about it. Every moment of our life, we are acting. Action is there, even when we are sleeping. Body is acting. Because Gurudev used to say that the moment this body stops acting, what happens? There are minimum 4 people ready to put you on their shoulder. Take you to either put you under 6 feet of dirt or cremate. So act you must, right? Contact you must. Your entire life is based on your contact with the rest of the world, of which you are also part and parcel. You are not separate, different and distinct from the world. The totality includes the individuality. So you are the world. So knowing that we absolutely have no choice but to contact, why not learn? How? We are intelligent people. Over the whatever millions of years that the humankind has persevered and developed into a better and better and better being, to the point where we can, short order of 6, 7 years, 8 years probably, go to moon, put our feet on the moon. Think of that. It's not a little act, it's a profound event. What you see every full moon night and otherwise rolling around the sky, thinking that someone from our family, because the world is our family, someone from my family went and stood on the moon. How amazing that is! Because we focused on, because we set our mind to it. Human beings are capable of doing that. And therefore, we have no excuse. No wishy-washy. Oh yeah, today, tomorrow, nah, tomorrow, day after tomorrow. It's going to happen. It's not going to happen, folks, if it's only part of your long bucket list. It's not going to happen. The art of right contact is only going to happen when we discipline ourselves to understand, comprehend, and master that art. Then the world becomes fun. then you're always happy. No matter what the outside conditions are, you are always happy. Because you know exactly what's happening around you. There is no snake, only a rope. And there is no fear. So that art of right contact, which brings in turn peace and prosperity, that's what we want. Peace and prosperity. So that right way of interacting with this world, once developed, can bring that peace and prosperity that's so elusive at times. It's here and then it slips out of your hand. You don't know where it went. So then, there are various ways to look at this world. Someone says, glass is only half full. Some others say, glass is only half empty. Both mean the same thing, actually, essentially. The meaning is exactly the same, but the connotation is different. The connotation, on one hand, is positive when you see it half full, and the other half empty is a negative connotation. That negativity is what holds us back constantly. And so this removal of negativity from our thought process immediately gives us that higher level of confidence as to how to interact with the world of things and beings. Again, as we said before, developing this art of right contact takes a while. Because Gurudev used to say that it is like this. You are driving at 70 miles an hour on a highway. And someone sitting next to you says, let's make a U-turn. No, you can't do that. No, you cannot do that. Otherwise, you will endanger so many lives, properties, and whatnot, including yours. So if you're driving at 70 miles an hour, first you have to slow. Then you have to look around and see the traffic. Get into the left lane, or leftmost. Then at the right place where it says, it doesn't say no U-turn. Otherwise, you're in trouble. Slow down, and when you are slowing down and finding a place where you could make a U-turn, that U-turn requires you to be 5 miles an hour. Then you can make a safe U-turn. So when we are trying to get rid of all these negativities, it's not going to happen instantaneously. It's a process. It's a process that slowly, with proper focus, proper determination, perseverance, resilience, we keep working on it without getting dissuaded, without getting discouraged, disheartened. Keep working on it. Keep working. Then slowly it becomes a way of life. That's why when you see saints and sages, it doesn't matter who's what denomination they belong to, but when you see these pious people, when you meet them, you have this amazing experience of positive energy, isn't it? Because that's what they exude. And that's why the first thing we do, right of contact, developing right art of good. Keep good company. depending on the time and your inclination, aptitude and attitude, both, one of the best companions can be a good book. Rather than watching TV and neither watching TV totally, neither reading the book, talking to different people, such a waste of energy. Do what you do, but do it right. Stay focused. So, the process of developing the art of right contact is to give up all the negativities. How do you start doing that? First things first, be grateful. Be very, very grateful to anyone and everyone that has done something for you. However infinitesimal small it is, be thankful. Express your gratitude to the Lord every day. Every day when you go to bed, you are healthy and you have had a good day and you have no tension, you can fall into the bed and fast asleep within 2 minutes. That's the Lord's blessing. So continuously express your gratitude to the Lord. The second thing we have to do, and this is the hardest, believe me, is know the difference between needs and desires. Needs are very, very few. Desires are unlimited. Mahatma Gandhi used to say that this world has enough food for everyone's need, but it will never be enough for everyone's desires. Hoarding without reason. In 50s, that was the biggest problem because the whole world depended on United States of America for food. I don't know how many of us remember PL 480. That was the law passed by United States Congress that allowed the United States of America to export excess wheat that they used to throw away in the sea. That raid, remember when you were a little baby, you probably do, I do. That wheat used to be sold to the third world country. It's only source. Second World War had done such a monumental damage to every country's economy. Even those that were not directly or even not much indirectly involved, even they were affected. Because the world economy is one economy. You can't put compartmentalization anywhere, assuming that it will not run away from you. No, that's not how it happened. So, that's in that context Mahatma Gandhi had said this. There is enough food for the entire world's need, but never will be enough for everyone's desires. We need to understand. So, the second biggest requirement that we work with is understand the difference between needs and desires. Fulfilling your needs is very critical to your welfare, well-being, peace, prosperity, health. No problem. Indiscriminate desires that in turn create those negative thoughts of how can I take what he has? That's where the problem. We need to understand that. the more prosperous we are as people, as country, as economy, as community, the more we must think of how to share whatever we can with others. That is the most critical aspect of developing this art of right heart. And that will lead into the next one, as the book says, explains the second chapter. Always look at what you have. Look around and see somebody who is less fortunate than you, who do not have that. Be thankful that you do have it. Because there are many that do not have what we have. It's a very hard thing to do. And therefore, the fourth requirement specified is share what we have. Share what we have. Philanthropy is not limited to the extremely wealthy. The smallest, most modest person, individual, can be a great philanthropist. It's not what you give, okay? It's not what one gives. It is the thought, the feeling with which you give. The idea here is that if you give something to someone, feel grateful that you had the opportunity to give. Thank the Lord for that. But that automatically implies that I had little more than what I absolutely needed. So it was an absolute must that I should share. So sharing with others who are not as fortunate as we are. All these things, what do they do? They don't put a halo in the back of your head, okay? They don't make you walk on water or something like that. The inner peace develops because of it, which is what is called purity of mind. See, all these things are specified and discussed because the ultimate idea is to get to a stage where your mind is so purified, so pure. There is no unnecessary disturbance in it. Because in that mind, that thought that I am free, I am this whole universe of things, that thought shines. I am is meditation. As soon as you attach something with that I am, problems. Right? Every day. So I am is the thought. So when you sit in the seat of meditation, as the thoughts, extraneous thoughts, drop out, only one thought will remain: me and my Lord. When that thought drops, only I, then you are in meditation. An it is that status, that state of mind that we want to reach eventually in our life, in this life, not some other life. Okay, I'll come back, so what? No. This life only. When that level of purity of mind develops, the clarity of thought is automatic. Again, we have done this in a more relative fashion. When you get rid of extraneous thought because something so critical in your life that you're doing that affects everything and everybody around you, your focus is only on that one thing, every other thought is out. And in that state of mind, your clarity of thought is amazing, right? Even though relative, even though action is relative, for that particular action, we are able to develop that clarity of thought. Why do some children, some young adults get to become valedictorian in the graduation class and some only barely pass? Same result. Clarity of thought that comes because you have developed this wonderful ability to control your mind at will. You'll see a lot of people in our lives. We run into a lot of such people. Sometimes you wonder, how did that happen? How do they do that? This is the only way. So, developing this positive attitudes, thoughts, and actions, we can successfully develop the art of right contact with this world. So, one other suggestion that is being made is that we should not crave for objects that are unnecessary and do not really add to anything that we have in terms of additional happiness or joy. We just become extravagant. Try to do that. It's very, very hard. Very, very hard. Because that ego, that I, is so powerful. Because you see your neighbor having the latest model of, what is that car? Tesla. My God, if I don't have a Tesla on my driveway, how bad would I look? What's the difference to you? That is the thing. To be able to resist that tendency and say, no, I don't need it. I have a conveyance that works very well. It's very reliable. It takes me from one point to the other, which is all I need. That is the because the ego gets bruised very quickly. So, not craving for things that are not going to add any happiness, any joy to your life. But by doing that, it'll only create more sorrows and unhappiness. So, once we work on this, constantly, continuously, for an extended period of time with complete focus, perseverance, sustained effort, then this will become our second nature. Then you will always be in meditation, where wherever you are, whatever you are doing, whoever you are interacting with, you will be always in meditative state. That is freedom. That is freedom. So with that, we'll do about 2-3 minutes of very short meditation, please. Sit straight, not like me. Actually, in all fairness, that doesn't matter. That's not necessarily conducive. Just stay focused, sit straight, relax. Take deep breath as you can. Exhale. Let the breathing be normal. I am not a man. I am not a woman. That is for the gender. That's for the body. I am that auspicious one. That which pervades this entire universe. That's who I am. Om Shanti, 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 Hari Yoga. For next few minutes, keep this thought in your mind. As you move about, keep this thought. slowly open your eyes. Be relaxed. So what we just tried doing is essentially contemplation. We acted. So that's the step towards ultimate state of meditation, the meditative state. Meditation is being attached there. Interacting here. So that's that constant connection must be maintained. So that what we are doing in our day-to-day lives does not affect us negatively. So I thank you all for coming, really appreciate that, and next week Anilji will be back, I'm sure, and he will continue with comments on second chapter and then further on third, fourth, etc. Any questions, be happy to try and answer, if at all. I'm sure Anilji has shared some thoughts of how to pursue this development of positivity at all times, equipoise. One of the ways is to go home quickly, write down in bullet points what we talked about today. Then go over each of them, see how clear it is. And if it's not, mark the intention that next time you will question. Because if you don't ask questions, you will never learn. Never. It's your birthright to ask questions. That's the only way we can attain this knowledge. I wish I had more time than, because I have some stories about how this question business works for you. Very beautiful story coming from the Vedas. Maybe next time we get together somewhere, we'll talk about it. Thank you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes. Thanks. Thanks very kindly. Thank you. Thank you. I have some questions on chapter 1 and 2. Developed, I'll share them with Anilji and then he can pass it on to you if you want to look into that. So we have another class at 8 o'clock, so we'll get ready for that. It's an interesting class for all of us. It's on Ramacharitamanas, the story of the Lord Rama. People think that when you study stories, you know, it's just kind of story, it's fun, it's, you know, telltale and that sort of, no. So profound. This same knowledge that we're trying to acquire through good books like this, exactly the same. It just in a little more, presented in a little more acceptable, easily understandable way. But the bottom line is the same.